I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to speak at the conference. So this talk is based on this paper and is concerned about realizing gravity from quantum matter system. So I will first briefly review how one may understand the ADS-CFT, which is an example of emergent gravity from a field theory point of view. And then I will discuss how one may use that framework to understand emergence of time. And please stop me anytime if you have any question in the middle. So ADS-CFT correspondence is a conjecture that relates a quantum field theory in d-dimensional space and time with a gravitational theory in one higher dimensional space and time. And this duality can be very useful, for example, to understand some non-perturbative dynamics of strongly coupled quantum field theory using weakly coupled gravity. Or you can also use our intuition on quantum field theory to understand some open questions in quantum gravity. And although a lot of progress has been made in both directions in the past, there are still many open questions. And it will be nice to have a more microscopic understanding of this correspondence to understand some of unsolved problems. For example, if you have a strongly coupled quantum field theory that you realize in your lab, but it's not easy to embed it within a string theory, then you may want to have a way to construct a gravitational dual starting from your quantum field theory. And also, so far, this ADS-CFT hasn't been able to give a very definite answer how black hole information puzzle is resolved. And for this kind of problem, it is desired to have a more microscopic understanding of this correspondence. So that's the, and this talk is about understanding gravitational theory from field theory perspective. Okay, so let's start with a quantum field theory. So say phi is my fundamental degrees freedom. And for simplicity, let's focus on Euclidean space and time. And this S is the action for this fundamental field. And imagine this, my field theory is defined on a curved space and time with this fixed metric. So this is a fixed metric, but it's in general curved. And then my generating function is going to be dependent on the space metric on which my field theory is put on. Okay? And besides the metric, you can in principle have other sources that you can turn on within your field theory. And for simplicity, I have some matrix field theory in mind, but this is not important. And then within the matrix field theory, this action suppose have a term that has only single trace operators like this. Then I also assume that this action and the path integration has been regularized to satisfy the general covariance so that your generating function is invariant under under spatial, this diffeomorphism generated by this vector field. Okay, so this is just the object that we want to know in quantum field theory from which you can compute correlation functions. And then question is, how do we understand the emergence of gravity from this field theory object? So the first step is to consider a coarse graining, and unlike the usual coarse graining, you can do coarse graining in a local way. So, for example, the same generating function, and then is given by the following object, where you rescale your metric in a space-time dependent way, and n of x is a space-time dependent function by some infinitesimal parameter dz. So this is a rescaled metric. So you rescaled your space locally. This is a local wild factor. And then you can ask what kind of quantum correction you have to add to reproduce the same generating function. Okay? And then this delta S prime can be understood as a quantum correction that is generated by this coarse grain, some local coarse grain. Then I can combine the correction coming from this rescaling and this correction into delta S. Okay, and then here I have the original action. And then from the renormalization group study, from field theory, and also from holographic study, people have learned that this delta S in general includes, in the example of the matrix model, not only includes the like operator that involves one trace like this, but also it includes products of this single trace operator. So they are called multi-trace operator. So for example, you have this T mu nu is the energy momentum tensor associated with this single trace action. But in this delta S, you have to include not just the linear term in T mu nu, but a higher order term in T mu nu like this. Okay? So the basic idea is that under RG, under coarse graining, you in general generate all operators that are comparable with your symmetry, and they are all comparable. So they are generated. And then you can, under the usual Wilsonian RG, you can repeat these steps, right? And then you rescale your metric again, then you generate another quantum correction. And that's the usual Wilsonian RG flow. And this Wilsonian RG flow is defined in the space of all multi-trace operators, not just in the single-trace sector, which is what we are familiar with. But there is a way to effectively project your RG flow within the subspace of single-trace source only. And that is done by promoting the source. So here I view the metric as a source, because if I change the metric, I effectively turn on some source for the energy momentum tensor, right? So therefore, I view the metric as a source. And then by promoting the source for the single trace operator to be a dynamical variable, you can remove this multi-trace operator. For example, I can reproduce this generating function in the presence of this multi-trace operator from the partition function that includes only the single trace source by integrating over the source for the single trace operator with appropriate weight. Okay? And this is a statement that you can prove. You can always find some Boltzmann-like weight which determines the probability distribution for the source, so that if you integrate out those this source, then you reproduce this action with a multi-trace operator. So effectively, your full RG flow, the Wilsonian RG flow, is defined in the space of all possible operators, including single trace and multi-trace operator. But here, what I am claiming is that RG flow can be projected into the much smaller subspace that involves only single trace operators. If you just truncate the multi-trace operators out, then that introduces an error. But now, by introducing the fluctuations within the space of single trace operators, you can reproduce the effect of the multi-trace operators. So, and if you repeat this step, your generating function can be now given by some over all RG paths that lie within the space of the single trace operator. So in this sense, it's a path integration for your RG flow. And then for each RG path, you can construct a weight. And the weight for each RG path is determined by some dynamical action for the RG path. Okay? And then you can view that as a Hamiltonian flow. And then the Hamiltonian for the dynamical source and its conjugate variable is precisely determined by the beta function that I have here, the quantum correction for general multi-trace operator in the presence of single trace operator. So if you know the beta function, then you can construct an action for the single trace source. And then using the that action determines the weight for each RG path. And your job is to sum over all RG paths within the single trace subspace. And that gives you the exact the generating function.
Sorry, and L counts the number of traces?
No, this L is the number of RG steps. So here I showed first step, right? And then I repeat these steps again. And then at every step, I end up introducing one fluctuating single trace source. Okay, so.
So it's secretly a continuous variable.
Yeah. So it's at every step you have a change of scale by dz, and then you make dz infinitesimally small and make this step infinitely many. Then this step RG step L become a continuous scale variable. So that's the picture. Any other question? Okay. And then this quantum RG can be also understood in a slightly different way. And this viewpoint is useful in understanding the emergent time. So let me discuss that. So this same generating function for this Euclidean field theory actually can be viewed as an overlap between two quantum states. So what are these quantum states? For example, this quantum state labeled by this G mu nu metric is a state that is defined on a space-time. Okay, this phi is some basis vector for space-time configuration of the field phi. Okay, so this x, this is a field operator defined at every point in Euclidean space and time. And this phi is an eigenstate with eigenvalue phi of x for that field operator. Okay? And then you promote this Boltzmann weight e to the minus s as an wave function, okay, for your meta field phi. And then because your field theory is defined on some metric, now this state depends on this metric, right? So that's how I label my state in terms of this metric. So this is one state that I can, what I call UV state, which is defined from the action of the field theory. Basically, you promote your action into wave function. And then that defines a state on a space and time. And then this state, zero IR, what I call IR state, is some state which has this property, which has overlap one with any basis vector. Okay? Then you can immediately see that the overlap between this state and this state is the same as the generating function that you already originally had, right? Okay, so this is just the mathematics, but you can define such a state. So why is it this useful? The reason why this is useful is because you can now view the coarse graining procedure as some kind of quantum evolution that happens within the Hilbert space that is defined on this space and time. So I can define some quantum operator H hat whose action on this state, so this is some Euclidean evolution generated by this Hamiltonian density Hx with some nx is again this space-dependent speed of coarse graining. And then when this operator acts on this state, you can construct your Hamiltonian such that this resulting state coincides with this new state, which has your original action and this quantum correction that you would have in the original RG procedure. Okay? Although I didn't show you what this Hamiltonian is, you can construct a Hamiltonian that does this job. And then also, you can choose your Hamiltonian such that it annihilates your IR state, such that when you insert this evolution operator between this overlap 0 and G, it preserves the overlap, right? Because this operator annihilates this reference, the IR state. So, and however, this it acts non-trivially on this state because it generates some evolution. Okay? So basically, RG coarse graining can be viewed as this kind of quantum flow generated by some operator, which acts trivially on a IR state, but on a non-trivially on this UV state. And then the flow of this UV state under this quantum evolution can be understood as a RG flow. Okay, that's an alternative viewpoint. Okay. And then here, the fact that this IR state is, so this H is on some operator that generates the coarse graining, and the fact that this state is invariant under that evolution means that this is a state that is associated with the fixed point under this coarse graining procedure. Okay, any question about this point? Yeah.
Do you mind?
I'm a little confused about the state zero. So you say it has overlap one with any of these coherences?
Yeah, so it's not normalizable state. So it's kind of, wave function is one.
But it doesn't depend on phi, or any phi.
So it's like this wave function is one, so that it has overlap one with any basis. So it's not normalizable state.
You might be repeating the last point about the fixed point.
Here.
Yeah. Can you repeat that quickly? Why?
So this is the operator that generates the coarse graining. And then this statement means that this state is invariant under that evolution. So that in that sense, it describes a fixed point. Okay. So the picture is that, in a Euclidean space-time, say, I have a quantum field theory that is defined on some fixed curve space and time background. And then I can associate a wave function defined in the space of a metric, which is a delta function, because I start with a theory with some fixed background metric. But now, under the coarse graining, if I apply this coarse graining operator to this kind of state with a fixed metric, in general, it evolves into state that have a linear, that can be represented as a linear superposition of a state with different metric. Okay? So it is this line represent that. So you this is your initial state, UV state, and you apply this coarse graining operator, and then after RG time Z, you in general end up having state that is given by some linear superposition of your single trace state with a wave function now that depends on your RG time, and this wave function is defined in the space of your metric. It's a single trace source, right? Then now you can ask, what is the Hamiltonian? What is the dynamics that governs the evolution of this wave function defined in the space of metric? So as a function of RG times Z, this wave function will evolve according to some quantum Hamiltonian, but that generates the coarse graining transformation. And it's going to be a Hamiltonian that involves both metric and derivative with respect to metric, etc. Okay? And then here, one point that is important is that so this is some Hamiltonian for gravity. Okay, so the point is that in this sense, any quantum field theory, the RG flow can be understood as a dynamical gravity. And then here, usually in dynamical gravity, the Hamiltonian is a generator for timely parameterization transformation, right? And timely parameterization is a part of the diffeomorphism invariant, diffeomorphism transformation. And therefore, people usually think that the physical state must be invariant under timely parameterization transformation, and therefore they must be annihilated by Hamiltonian. Right? That's the user thinking. However, in this context, this UV state, say, that has a wave function that is peaked at some particular metric, does not satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint. It is not annihilated by the coarse graining operator. Okay? So that's an important point. Okay, so and now we would like to extend this construction. Yes.
One question. So before you mentioned the word identity that your partition function must satisfy, right?
Which yeah.
Basically, diffeomorphism invariant. How does this translate into the Hamiltonian that you have?
Okay. Yeah. So that's a good question. So word identities for this quantity, right? However, this state, this UV state, does not is not invariant under diffeo, but this reference state is. So if I insert some momentum operator that generates a special diffeo in between, this state is annihilated by that, but this state is not. Okay? That's how the world identity for this overlap comes about. Yeah, so instead of Hamiltonian, you can have now momentum operator with some vector field here. And then this IR state is invariant under any local shift. So therefore, it doesn't change the overlap, but it acts non-trivially on this state. In particular, when this momentum is acted upon this state, it changes the metric such that you have some special shift. Okay, so now we would like to extend this framework to a different setting where in the previous case the emergent direction was RG direction, and that corresponds to a spatial direction in the bulk. But now we want to extend this setup to the case where the emergent direction is time. Okay. So in the previous case, we start with some local quantum field theory defined on a space-time, right? And then you had a coarse graining, and then coarse graining corresponds to some bulk evolution in the dual gravitation theory, and then the physical observable was a generating function of your field theory, which is given by overlap between some UV state and IR state, which is defined on a space time. Right? That was the previous setup.
Sorry, before you move on, so I'm a little confused by the statement that the IR state is a fixed.
Okay.
Usually, we don't think of states as being fixed points.
Yeah, so this state is not a state that is defined on a spatial slice. This is a state that is defined on a space and time. So actually, this state corresponds to an action. So because I define the state for associated with an action. Okay, so I promoted this Boltzmann weight into wave function for my state. And my state are now space-time state.
Yeah, but according to your definition of the IR state, the action that you're using there is one, zero. No?
Right, so this state is invariant under this coarse graining. And this state is a trivial state. This is a direct product state in space and time. It's like a trivial insulator. it has a zero correlation, zero space-time correlation. And that's one fixed point.
Yeah, that's what I'm confused about. I don't get the connection between states and fixed points.
Okay, so first thing to realize is that for every action of your quantum field theory, you can define a state, okay? And then RG transformation, RG evolution of your action can be viewed as some quantum evolution of your state, okay? So therefore, fixed point is some action which is invariant under coarse graining. And that fixed point corresponds to a state which does not evolve under evolution generated by the coarse graining operator.
I understand, but it seems to me that according to your definition of IR state,
yes,
the action associated with the IR state is trivial because you're saying it has overlap one with all the, sorry if you go back, the definition of your state zero as overlap one.
This is just, this defines what this state is, right?
Exactly.
Zero is just a uniform linear superposition of all the basis state.
Yeah, we're replacing e to the minus s with just
one, right? That's the state zero, right?
Exactly. So it seems to me that it's the fixed point that you're talking about is action equals zero according to this definition.
Yes, and what I'm saying, that is the fixed point that describes a trivial insulator.
Okay.
So imagine, say, FIFO theory, right? And then you can have a gapped phase, right? A massive phase. And then the fixed point action for that phase is just one. Yeah, zero. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So what I described this problem. Now I want to have a situation where instead of quantum field theory defined on space and time, I want to start with a quantum state defined on a spatial manifold, right? I want time to be emergent, so I start with a quantum state without time. So I start with a spatial manifold, and on the spatial manifold, I have some matter field, okay? And then just as I consider the local quantum field theory, the natural object we can consider here is a short-range entangled state. Because as you can foresee, e to the minus s is kind of the action. S was play the role of the wave function. So state that corresponds to local action actually corresponds to a short-range entangled state. Okay? And then instead of coarse graining, I want to have some unitary evolution, which corresponds to time evolution. And then the IR state here was a fixed point action. But here, my IR state must be some state which is invariant under this unitary evolution and also the shift, momentum shift. Okay? And that state must be a topological state, given that that state is invariant under any spatial diffeomorphism. So you can have a state of the wave function for the matter field, which is invariant under spatial diffeomorphism. That state must be some topological state. Okay? And it must have zero energy because it's, again, invariant under this unitary evolution. And then here, the physical observer was overlap between IR state and the UV state. Again, here, the physical observer is the overlap between this IR state and the UV state, and that can be viewed as a wave function of this IR state measured in this basis. More concretely, I have now, instead of an action, I have a state on a spatial manifold, which is labeled by some spatial metric, G mu nu. Okay? And this is some IR state. And this I can view as a, now this can be viewed as a wave function instead of a generating function of this state measured in this basis. Right? That's the object that corresponds to the generating function, the earlier case. So this is a wave function where this state is a state of some matter field whose wave function, instead of e to the minus s, now I have a wave function, real wave function of the matter field. And this wave function depends on this metric as well. So this metric is like a variational parameter or some collective variable of your matter field. And so different wave different metric gives different wave function for the matter field. And now this basis vector is really the basis vector defined on a spatial manifold. And then your IR wave function can be in general written at, can be written as a linear superposition of those states. And now, starting from that overlap between IR and UV state, I insert some unitary operator that is generated by this Hamiltonian density, H of x. And then again, this nx of tau is a space-time dependent lattice that generate different speed of unitary evolution at different points in space and time. And then I choose my Hamiltonian density such that it annihilates my IR state. So again, this guarantees that this wave function is invariant under insertion of this unitary evolution. On the other hand, when this axon to the right, it generates some non-trivial evolution of your state. Okay? So after you evolve for, say, time t, your state will be in general given by some linear superposition of this state, which are labeled by different metric, and you can define a wave function chi defined in the space of metric, and then this depends on time. Okay. Then you can ask now, how does this wave function for the metric evolve as a function of time? And then you can ask, what kind of Hamiltonian for the matter field can generate general relativity? So that is a question that I would like to address. So this so far, it has been the general setup. Let me now discuss more concrete example. Okay. So here is the setup. So suppose I have a three-dimensional spatial manifold with fixed topology. So for simplicity, let's say it's a three torus. Okay. And then on this spatial manifold, I have, say, n by n, Hermitian matrix field. Okay, so this is my matrix field defined on a spatial manifold. And then the full Hilbert space of this matter field is, of course, spanned by this basis vector. And this basis vector is just the eigenvector for the field operator. Okay? And most general state will be given by linear superposition of those basis vectors. Okay? And you can define the inner product, which is as user. Now, within the full Hilbert space of the matter field, I want to consider a sub-Hilbert space V, which is spanned by a set of basis vector. And those basis vectors are labeled by a special triad and a scalar field. So triad is just a square root of your positive, non-negative spatial metric. So triad E is a square of that gives a non-negative Riemannian metric on a spatial manifold. And then on an additional scalar field sigma. So I want to consider a set of states which are labeled by a metric or triad and a scalar field. And it's given by, of course, linear superposition of those basis vector. And this phi is my wave function, okay, for this state. And this is like choosing this wave function is like choosing the action in our earlier discussion on the quantum RG. But here, I'm going to choose a simplest wave function, which is a Gaussian wave function. So this psi, the wave function for the matter field is a e to d, some local quadratic function. Okay? And this kr is basically some two-derivative elliptic operator, but it's regularized using some heat corner scheme. It's not the specific regularization scheme is not important. What is important is that this is roughly speaking the two derivative operator, but with a short distance cutoff LC. Okay? So when the wave number is much smaller than inverse of LC, this behaves like just a two derivative operator. But when the wave vector is much larger than inverse of LC, it saturates to some constant. It's just a regularized two derivative operators, which generate entanglement in space. So without derivative term in the wave function, you wouldn't have entanglement in space. Then it is important to note that this, in the derivative operator, you have the metric, which is given by this triad. Okay? So, and this metric provides the notion of distance in this corner. Okay, so state with a different metric will have different amount of entanglement by construction in this wave function. Okay? And then this is some constant that you have to add to normalize your wave function. Okay, and then there are some properties that you can derive. For example, the inner product between two states which are labeled by different metric and the scalar field are not generally orthogonal. But in the larger limit, when the n by n, this matrix size is very large, the inner product between state with different collective variable goes to zero, as we expect, because there are a large number of metafields that are defined by same collective variable, so that in the larger limit, state with different collective variable become orthogonal, essentially. And furthermore, the inner product between two states is invariant under special diffeomorphism. In other words, the inner product between state E and E prime is same as this E tilde prime, where this tilde variables are related to the original variable through the spatial diffeomorphism. Right? In other words, if you have a state with one metric and another metric, the inner product between these two states is same as this inner product between spatially translated state. And once you have a well-defined inner product, now you can define the measure for the functional integration in the space of metric. Okay? So basically, for a fixed E prime and sigma prime, you define the measure such that this is one. So the physical picture is that you assign volume one for every region in the space of the metric that support one orthogonal state. Okay. That's the physical meaning of the measure. And then what are the physical meaning of those metric and this scalar field? So this metric is like a coefficient in front of two derivative term, and this scalar field sigma is like a mass term. Okay? So it looks like a mass and then the metric in terms of the action. But as a state, what does this corresponds to. So that's the next thing. So this metric is actually a variational parameter that quantifies the amount of entanglement within your state. For example, if you compute the von Neumann entanglement entropy of a region A in your space for this state with some fixed triad E and scalar field sigma, then you get to the leading order that the von Neumann entanglement entropy is given by the area of this boundary, which is this one, which is measured with this metric, GE. Note that this E is a variational parameter in your state, right? And then state with different metric gives different proper distance, proper volume, for proper area for this boundary, right? So therefore, state with different collective variable will give different entanglement. Okay?
This is for any region?
Or yeah, this is for any region.
Even if it's contracted into a point?
Yeah, it can be sphere or any region. So for any, so the this wave function has been constructed such that this metric parameterizes the amount of entanglement such that for any given region in space, the entanglement entropy is given by the boundary area measured with respect to that metric. And then this scalar field is another variational parameter, another collective variable, and this one measures the range of mutual information. For example, if I have two separate points, x and y, in space, and measure the mutual information, and then it decays exponentially in the proper distance between x and y, which is again measured with the metric associated with this triad E. And then the rate of the decay is controlled by this scalar field sigma. So larger the scalar field sigma, the faster the mutual information decays in space. So in this sense, this metric and this collective variable sigma are some variational parameters of the quantum state of the matter field that quantify the entanglement structure. And then, the most general state within the sub-Hilbert space is given by some linear superposition of those basis state. Now you can think about the wave function chi defined on this basis state. And among those kind of state, one can consider a semi-classical state where this wave function is peaked at some classical values of the metric and the scalar field with some oscillation where this oscillation defines some well-defined conjugate momentum. So this is kind of wave packet defined in the space of collective variable. And for this kind of state, and if you measure the entanglement entropy of a region in this state, you have actually additional contribution. The first contribution is the entanglement entropy that I already mentioned. So that is the entanglement entropy generated by this n square method degree freedom defined on some classical background metric E bar. So if I consider some semi-classical state with metric is centered at E bar, then the first contribution is order of n square, because I have n square matter field, and it obeys the area rule with respect to the classical metric. But now, in addition to this, I have additional contribution that comes from the fluctuation of the collective variable, because now I have this non-trivial width in the wave function for the collective variable. And since I have only order one collective variable, this singlet entanglement entropy, this additional contribution, is order of one, and is generated by correlation between fluctuations of the collective variable. However, this is not necessarily smaller than this, because unlike this color entanglement entropy, this singlet entanglement entropy can obey volume law if there's a long-range correlation between the fluctuations of the collective variable. So depending on your state, this or this may be larger. But the key point here is that there are two different contributions to the entanglement entropy. And now one can think about, so far it is the kinematics. So I start with the Hilbert space for the metal field, and I consider a sub-Hilbert space which is spanned by some basis vectors. Each basis vector is associated with some collective variable. So this is the full Hilbert space, and this plane is supposed to represent this sub-Hilbert space, which is spanned by these basis vectors. And now, suppose I start with some initial state within this sub-Hilbert space, say chi, and I want to consider a operator for the metafield which maps this subhilbert space into the subhilbert space, such that this evolution generated by this operator stays within this subhilbert space. Okay? And one of those operators is the usual momentum operator. So this is the momentum operator of your field theory, usually, which is the generator of the local space diffeomorphism. Then if you apply this momentum operator to this general state within this subspace, which is given by linear superposition of those basis vector, you can show that this is equivalent to some differential operator acting on the wave function for the collective variable, where this differential operator is nothing but the generator for this collective variable, the shift for this collective variable. And I'm just saying that this is a one operator for the meta field, which maps this subhilbert space into subhilbert space. But this is rather a trivial example because it's just a shift in space. You can also consider a Hamiltonian. One can ask if there is a Hamiltonian for the meta field, Hamiltonian density for the meta field. So this H hat is constructed from this quantum operator for the meta field. And you can ask if one can construct an operator Hamiltonian such that when it acts on this state, this evolution is described by the time evolution of general relativity. Okay? So this is a natural question you can ask. And indeed, you can construct such Hamiltonian. There exists a Hamiltonian for the meta field whose flow within this subspace coincides with the Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian of general relativity. Okay? So I'm not going to show the expression, but that Hamiltonian has the following interesting property. So it has some sense of space dependency. So let me explain what it is. So suppose my state, say this state, has a two component. Say this one component associated with metric GE and another component associated with metric GE prime. And alpha, betas are just different weight in the linear superposition. And then this H hat is a Hamiltonian for the meta field, which gives rise to the Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian for general relativity. And then that Hamiltonian has the following property. When this Hamiltonian acts on this state, it acts on this component of the vector and this component of vector differently. For example, the resulting state is given by linear superposition of one Hamiltonian that depends on GE acting on this basis vector, plus another Hamiltonian that depends on this GE prime acting on this basis vector. Okay? So it's like if you have a two orthogonal component of your basis vector, your Hamiltonian acts on this component and this component in a different way.
Okay. Isn't that always the case for a linear operator? Meaning
yeah, so as far as this and this are orthogonal, this is still a linear operator. And then this has this is a bit of, it's a linear operator, but it has some flavor of state dependency. And then, interestingly, this Hamiltonian, as an operator, is not a local operator. Okay? But it has a weaker sense of locality called relative locality. In other words, although it's a local, non-local Hamiltonian, when it acts on some short-range entangled state, it acts like a local Hamiltonian. So in other words, the range of the interaction between two points in the Hamiltonian depends on state on which the Hamiltonian acts on. For example, suppose I have a state where the proper distance between A and B is very large. Okay? So this is a state where entanglement between point A and B is very small. Okay? And then when this Hamiltonian acts on this state, only those operators that decays exponentially by short distance survive. Okay? So therefore, for this state, there's very little coupling between this point and this point. On the other hand, if you apply the same Hamiltonian to a state where the proper distance between this point and this point is very small, then for that state, the Hamiltonian generates large interaction between the two points. So in that sense, the strength of the coupling between two points is determined relatively to the state, relative to the amount of entanglement that is present in the state determine the strength of the coupling between the two points. So in that sense, it's a relatively local Hamiltonian. Okay? And the point is that the Hamiltonian that generate the Willard-Witt Hamiltonian, general relativity, has this property. Now we have a Hamiltonian for the matter field, which induces a Hamiltonian for general relativity. We can now study the time evolution of some matter state, which is given by some linear superposition of those base state, and we can ask how it time evolves. Okay. Let me skip this, and we can start with some semi-classical state with well-defined position and well-defined momentum. It's just the wave packet in the space of a collective variable. And in particular, it is of interest to study the fate of the time evolution that describes the black hole formation and evaporation. So suppose I prepare my initial state of some spherically collapsing mass shell. Okay? And then in the larger limit, this time evolution is dominated by the saddle point configuration, which is precisely coincide with the classical equation motion of GR. And so it will create a black hole. And suppose I choose my initial condition such that my size of the black hole is much larger than my cutoff scale, such that the time evolution is well described by local quantum field theory for a while. And then once you include 1/n correction, now you have to include the quantum fluctuation for the collective variable. And then those quantum fluctuations of collective variable are described by local field theory in the presence of this horizon. And therefore, there will be Hawking radiation. And then as Hawking radiation is emitted, the horizon size will decrease. And then as the horizon size decreases, what happens in this picture is that the color entanglement entropy decreases. So initially, it has this large color entanglement entropy. So right after the black hole is formed, the color entanglement is proportional to the area of the horizon. But the singulate entanglement entropy is very small because there is not much fluctuation for the collective variable. But as black hole evaporates for a long time, the horizon decreases. So therefore, color entanglement entropy decreases. However, this singulate entanglement entropy will increase because the Hawking radiation is emitted in the singulate sector. Okay, it's emitted in the form of the fluctuation of the collective variable. And as a result, the entanglement is gradually transferred from color sector to the singulate sector. So in that sense, black hole evaporation corresponds to entanglement neutralization process where entanglement is transferred from n squared color degrees freedom to order of one singlet degrees freedom. So the total entanglement doesn't necessarily decrease. And then this piece that obeys the error law, which we can identify as the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, does not capture the whole entanglement entropy that is present. It's only part of the entanglement. So in principle, at a later time when the black hole become very small, order of the cutoff size, the color entanglement entropy is negligible. But you'd expect to have a large entanglement entropy in the singular sector, and you can count the number of singulate degrees of freedom that are inside the horizon, and you can ask if there are enough singulate degrees of freedom that can support the entanglement with the early Hawking radiation. Then indeed, there are a large number of singlet modes that is enough to capture the entanglement entropy with the Euler Hawking radiation. This is just one possibility. Okay? And this is not a computation. This is a one scenario that is consistent within this frame. Okay, so let me finish. So here I talked about a quantum mechanical system of some matrix field. And you can find a Hamiltonian for the metal field whose evolution gives rise to general relativity in the some semi-classical limit. And such Hamiltonian is non-local, but it has a weaker notion of locality called relative locality in the sense that the strength of interaction between 2 points on the spatial manifold is determined relative to the amount of entanglement present in the state. Okay, so there's no absolute locality, but the notion of locality is determined relative to the state. Okay, and then within this framework, black hole evaporation corresponds to a unitary evolution where the entanglement is transferred from this color degree freedom to singlet degree freedom. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Cosmic censorship in this framework, which is if you start with a state in which the Hamiltonian acts locally and time evolve it using the relatively local Hamiltonian, does it stay in the space of states where it acts locally? Does it evolve into a state where it's not local?
Not necessarily. But I think within this black hole case, what happens is that it actually become more local because imagine you have some spatial shift and then you evolve, you start with this collapsing mass shell and then you form a black hole and then you evolve, so you start from this time slice and evolve to different time slice. Right? And then the proper distance within this throat become longer and longer, which means that the entanglement between say something here and outside this horizon become weaker and weaker. It's like a dynamical localization. So the coupling become weaker and weaker, and that manifests itself as the growing throat inside the horizon. But the opposite may happen as well. It may like if you have big crunch or something, then it become more Hamiltonian will become more non-local. Yeah.
Your line is very general. I'm wondering what are the properties of, let's say, peculiar properties of quantum field theories with standard gravity duals, meaning...
Right, okay, that's...
From what you said, it looks like any quantum field theory can be phrased in this...
So I guess within the first framework, this dot, dot, dot represent many other sources that you can turn on within the single trace sector, right? There is a source for the energy momentum tensor, but there will be source for some scalar operator and the higher spin operator, etc. Right? And in general, under the coarse graining, all of them become dynamical. So therefore, the theory that you get in the bulk is not a simple theory of gravity. Right? It involves not only fluctuating metric, but fluctuating single trace sources. So therefore, for general quantum field theory, you get some some theory that includes the dynamical gravity, but other dynamical variables as well. Okay, that's the first statement. And then you can ask, what do we need to have a simple gravity? Okay? And then for that, you need a gap in the scaling dimension of other operators. If energy momentum tensor is the only operator that has order of one scaling dimension, and if four other operators have very heavy, right? So in that case, yes, indeed, you have other dynamical variable, but they are heavy. they are very massive field in this graph. Okay, so that's the second statement. And then in the second framework, here, it's a little bit different. How I achieve this simple gravity is because by fine-tuning the Hamiltonian. So here, I consider a Hilbert sub-Hilbert space that has only metric and one scalar field, right? In general, if you just consider some arbitrary Hamiltonian of your metal field, in general, this flow will move out of this sub-Hilbert space. So then that means you will have to include some other variable to parameterize the larger Hilbert space. But that's one possibility. But here, what I'm saying is that one can fine-tune the Hamiltonian such that your Hamiltonian flow stays within this Hilbert space, such that it become only dynamical gravity and one scalar field. So this is by fine-tuning. But here, I just wanted to establish that there is a possibility, in principle, you can fine-tune the Hamiltonian to realize simple gravity.
I have a follow-up question about the Hamiltonian. So is it in general, it's going to depend on some couplings of the Hamiltonian. And so let's say in the ADS picture, your Hamiltonian generates algae flow. What happens to the couplings in the Hamiltonian?
Oh, what is the coupling in the Hamiltonian?
Yeah, so the coupling in the Hamiltonian as you proceed along the energy flow.
Right.
And it's just constant.
Right. So you are talking about these things, right?
Yeah.
So these things are fixed by the beta function of your field theory.
Okay.
So if you know the beta function, so this is this delta S, right? So delta S is nothing but the wild anomaly, so it gives the beta function. And this constant alpha beta g becomes the coupling in the Hamiltonian that generate the RG flow.
More questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
Did you say you have an example of a relatively local Hamiltonian? Which...
Yes, in the second case. In this case.
Can you show it to us?
The Hamiltonian?
Yeah.
The full Hamiltonian?
Yeah.
okay. So let me...
If you don't demand that it gives Einstein gravity, is there a simple example? Is that more
presentable? So, yes, this... Yeah, the Hamiltonian has this form. So I don't have a closed form expression, but this is, so this T is like a energy momentum tensor like operator constructed from the metal field. And then, so this is the matrix element of the Hamiltonian computed between some basis vector of your metal field, right? And it is given by some functional integration of the collective variable of this like double trace operators for the energy momentum tensor. This is the Hamiltonian that gives rise to the Einstein gravity in this particular example. So this is not very instructive. Maybe more instructive is this one. So Hamiltonian is roughly made of three pieces. The first, so here I just engineered what is the Hamiltonian for the metal field that gives rise to Einstein gravity, right? So that's, then this is the answer. And it has this following three pieces. First, this is like a projection operator to a state with particular collective variable. And then you have some input state, and then when you apply this Hamiltonian, you first project this state, decompose into different basis vector, right? And then for each selected collective variable, you have now you apply local operator where locality is measured with respect to that metric. And this local operator is relatively simple. It has some double trace energy momentum tensor and some operator that couples to the scalar field. And then now the difficult part is you have to sum over all possible collective variables. So this equation is supposed to represent this picture here. So when you have some state that is given by linear superposition of state with different collective variable, what the Hamiltonian first does, you decompose this into this basis and this basis. And you act one local Hamiltonian to this basis, and you act another local Hamiltonian to this basis. This is how the Hamiltonian become relatively local. And the Hamiltonian for general relativity cannot have any fixed local structure. You cannot have fixed derivative term, because that will introduce some background. And therefore, the Hamiltonian must be non-local in some way. But at the same time, it should be capable of having locality emergent in some state. And those states are short-range infinities.
All right, let's thank Vincent again.